Chapter 5 Fluoridation. The second item on Dr. Robert Mendelssohn's list of the four holy waters of the modern Church of Medicine is the fluoridation of the nation's drinking water. Although Dr. Mendelssohn dismisses it too, as of questionable value, few dare to question it. We are told that it confers untold benefits to the rising generation, guaranteeing them perpetual freedom from tooth decay and no need for any dental work. Surprisingly enough, the national fluoridation campaign is enthusiastically supported by the nation's dental profession, even though it might be expected that it would put them out of business. Here again, those in the know are well aware that the fluoridation program, far from threatening to put the dentists out of business, actually will offer them plenty of work in the future. The principal source of the fluoridation is a poisonous chemical, sodium fluoride, which has long been the principal ingredient of rat poison. Whether the adding of this compound to our drinking water is also part of a rat control program has never been publicly discussed. The EPA released its latest estimate that 38 million Americans are now drinking unsafe water, which contains unsafe levels of chlorine, lead, and other toxic substances. Fluoride is not listed as one of the toxic substances. EPA, like other government agencies, has carefully refrained from either testing public drinking water for the effects of fluoridation, or from poaching on the preserves of the Rockefeller monopoly, which launched the national fluoridation campaign. The byproduct of the manufacture of aluminum, sodium fluoride, had long posed a problem. Except for its limited use as a rat poison, other popular uses were limited by its extremely poisonous nature. It also was very expensive for the aluminum companies to dispose of. Because of its persistence, it does not degrade it is also cumulative in the body, so that each day you add a little more to your sodium fluoride reserves each time you drink a glass of water. It is puzzling, then, to find that the historical record shows that the principal sponsor and promoter of the fluoridation of the nation's drinking water was the U.S. Public Health Service. And thereby hangs the tale. We may recall the heady days of the 1950s, when public health officials were routinely sent out from Washington to appear at meetings, where communities were anxiously debating the pros and cons of water fluoridation. Without exception, these public servants not only reassured the anxious citizens, they positively demanded that the communities fluoridate their drinking water. Although they 91% unequivocally endorsed the fluoridation of water supplies, not one of these public health officials had ever conducted any studies of fluoridated water, or made any experiments as to its possible benefits or dangers. Yet at meeting after meeting throughout the United States, they rose to solemnly guarantee that there were no dangers, no side effects, only positive benefits on children under the age of 12. Fluoridation, even according to its most enthusiastic supporters, confers no benefits on anyone older than 12. No sensible reason has ever been advanced as to why all water supplies should be fluoridated, in order to benefit a minority of the population. Did these public servants know what they were doing? Of course not. They were following a tradition of the bureaucracy, which takes its orders from the medical monopoly. How did they get these orders? That too, is an interesting story. The head of the U.S. Public Health Service during the entire fluoridation campaign was one Oscar Ewing. A graduate of Harvard Law School, Ewing was an airplane contractor during the First World War. He then joined the influential law firm of Sherman, Hughes & Dwight, a prestigious Wall Street company. The Hughes was none other than Charles Evans Hughes, the recent candidate for the presidency of the United States. Hughes lost his campaign against Woodrow Wilson, because Wilson campaigned on his record that he kept us out of the war. As soon as he was safely re-elected, Wilson declared war. Hughes later became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The firm was then Ewing & Hughes. At the end of World War II, Ewing had himself appointed a special prosecutor for the Department of Justice. The appointment was made solely to conduct two prosecutions for the Rockefeller monopoly, the government's cases against two radio broadcasters, William Dudley Pelley and Robert Best. Both of these writers, longtime activists in America First, had campaigned to keep the United States out of what had turned out to be a very profitable war. They now had to be punished for their threat to the monopolists. Ewing had them both convicted and sent to prison. For this service, he was then appointed chairman of the Democratic National Committee. The following year, in 1946, President Truman appointed him head of the Federal Security Agency. In this capacity, he was in nominal charge of another radio broadcaster, Ezra Pound, who was being held as a political prisoner at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, a federal mental institution which was also part of the Federal Security Agency's network. Pound was held for more than 13 years without trial. Long after Ewing had gone, the government dropped all charges against Pound, and he was freed. The U.S. Public Health Service continues to propagandize, at taxpayers' expense, for expansion of fluoridation. The Washington Post noted on April 20, 1988 that the Public Health Service estimates that each year $2 billion is saved through water fluoridation. Our Public Health Service demurs on any statistical substantiation for this claim. Do the Public Health Service officials imply that the aluminum manufacturers save $2 billion a year through fluoridation of water? 92. However, Ewing had not been appointed administrator of the Federal Security Agency merely to prosecute Ezra Pound. There were more serious goals in view. Congressman Miller charged that Ewing had been paid a $750,000 fee to leave his profitable Wall Street practice and head the Federal Security Agency. This fee had been paid by the Rockefeller interests. The purpose was to pursue a national fluoridation campaign. Ewing was made head of the Federal Security Agency because this position made him the most powerful bureaucrat in Washington. This agency encompassed the U.S. Public Health Service, the Social Security Administration, and the Office of Education. As head of the FSA, he was in charge of the vast government post-war spending programs, the federal health, education and welfare programs. From this post, Ewing campaigned for greater government control over the citizens of the United States. He was particularly anxious to increase control of medical education, a prime goal of the Rockefeller interests, since 1898. On February 17, 1948, Ewing publicly called for government grants for medical scholarships, and demanded that medical schools be operated under government subsidies, with the inevitable accompanying control. On March 30, 1948, Ewing chaired a children's conference, which was intended to coordinate all federal agencies which had any dealing with the nation's youth. He also became the national leader of a campaign against cancer, a result of his long association with the Drug Trust M-He had been secretary of the giant Merck Drug Company from his offices at 1 Wall Street. One of Ewing's first moves, as head of the Public Health Service, was to throw out the longtime Surgeon General, Thomas Perrin, replacing him with a Ewing crony, Dr. Leonard Skeel from the National Cancer Institute. In 1948, Ewing joined with the American Cancer Society in a national campaign against cancer, a flagrant attempt to force Congress to spend more on various cancer boondoggles than the then modest expenditure of $14.5 million a year. On May 1, 1948, Ewing convened a national health convention in Washington, with some 800 delegates in attendance. The convention overwhelmingly approved Ewing's plea to enroll the United States in the United Nations World Health Organization. Ewing also campaigned vigorously for national health insurance, or socialized medicine, but despite his great power in Washington, he was unable to overcome the continued opposition of Morris Fishbein and the American Medical Association. He then issued an official report from the Federal Security Agency, the nation's health, a 186-page report which called for a crash 10-year program to achieve his goal of socialized medicine in the United States. The climax of his political power came when he masterminded Harry Truman's successful campaign for election to the presidency in 1948. Truman had previously succeeded as heir apparent after the strange death of Franklin D. Roosevelt. See Dr. Emanuel Josephson's book with that title. Ewing had already single-handedly obtained the naming of Truman as the vice presidential campaign in the 1944 Chicago Convention. M-He could 93. Be said to have put Truman in the White House, as certainly as Bobst was later to put in Richard Nixon. The 1948 election of Truman guaranteed Ewing that he could have anything he wanted in Washington. What he wanted, and what he had been paid to bring about, was the national fluoridation of our drinking water. Oscar Ewing is a name totally unknown to Americans today. He left no monuments, because he was the 20th century epitome of the ruthless, dedicated Soviet style of bureaucrat, answerable only to his masters, and contemptuous of the faceless masses over whom he exercised dictatorial powers. He wielded absolute control over the most important components of the new socialist bureaucracy which Roosevelt had built up in Washington, and he prepared these offices for cabinet status. Of his many bureaucratic mandates, perhaps none has had a more direct effect on all Americans than the fluoridation of our water supply. Congressman Miller stated that the chief supporter of the fluoridation of water is the U.S. Public Health Service. This is part of Mr. Ewing's Federal Security Agency. Mr. Ewing is one of the highly paid lawyers for the Aluminum Company of America. It was hardly accidental that Washington, D.C., where Oscar Ewing was king, was one of the first large American cities to fluoridate its water supply. At the same time, congressmen and other politicians in Washington were privately alerted by Ewing's minions that they should be careful about ingesting the fluoridated water. Supplies of bottled water from mountain springs then appeared in every office on Capitol Hill. These have been maintained continuously ever since, at the taxpayers' expense. One senator, who went so far as to carry a small flask of spring water with him when he dined at Washington's most fashionable restaurants, assuring his dinner companions that not one drop of fluoridated water will ever pass my lips. Such are the guardians of our nation. Even without such government additives as chlorine and fluorine, water itself may pose a serious threat to health. American pioneers often came down with an illness which they called milk sickness, which seems to have come from their water. Dr. N. M. Walker warns that in the average 70-year lifespan, the system ingests about 4,500 gallons of water containing some 300 pounds of lime. This intake of lime gradually ossifies the skeletal structure. In 1845, an English physician warned of the peril of ossification from drinking natural or spring water. When Congressman Miller reported on the floor of Congress that Oscar Ewing was promoting fluoridation, because he had been the lawyer for the Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa, and that he had accepted a $750,000 fee to persuade him to undertake this program of government service, one would have thought that this public exposure of Ewing's motives would have shamed him, and perhaps influenced him to step aside and let someone else take over the U.S. Public Health Service campaign to force fluoridation on the American people. This would underestimate the arrogance and the self-assurance of the 20th century bureaucrat. He 94-point ignored Congressman Miller's remarks, and redoubled the pressure of the U.S. Public Health Service to put over fluoridation. He had the willing support of his underlings, because the U.S. Public Health Service has never been in the service of the public. On the contrary, its officials have always been at the beck and call of the drug trust, pushing the latest fads from the medical monopoly, and maintaining those ideals of public service which have purchased so many fine estates in the fashionable Leesburg suburban area for those who have been in the right place at the right time. Political power is translated into money, money for those who use political goals for sale. After overseeing the installation of sodium fluoride equipment in most of the nation's large cities, an interest in which Chase Manhattan Bank showed a crucial concern, Oscar Ewing retired to Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1953. Here he busied himself with building a 7,800-acre complex of office buildings under the name of the Research Triangle Corporation, triangle being a key Masonic symbol. These offices were promptly leased to a melange of federal and state agencies, many of which, not surprisingly, he had previously done business with when he was their boss in Washington. A former head of the Democratic National Committee usually has no difficulty in renting space to government agencies. Ewing's former law partner, Charles Evans Hughes, J.R. Yen, became Solicitor General of the United States, while his father was still Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He later became a director of New York Life Insurance Company, a J.P. Morgan-controlled firm, whose office was at 1 Wall Street. This had also been Oscar Ewing's former business address. Fluorides have long been a source of contamination in the United States. Large quantities of this chemical are also produced by the giant chemical firms, American Agricultural Products Corporation, and Hooker Chemical. Hooker Chemical became part of the Rockefeller network when Blanchette Hooker married into the Rockefeller family by marrying John D. Rockefeller III. The Florida plant of American Agricultural produces enormous waste quantities of fluorides in preparing fertilizer from phosphate rock. Some of the fluoride wastes had been used in pesticides, until the Department of Agriculture banned their use, as being too dangerous to the public. The wastes were then dumped into the ocean, despite specific Department of Agriculture rulings prohibiting it. Hooker Chemical is known to most Americans for the life-threatening chemical wastes found at Love Canal. Studies by the National Academy of Science show that United States industries such as Hooker Chemical pump 100,000 tons of fluorides into the atmosphere each year. They pipe another 500,000 tons of fluorides into the nation's water supply each year. This is in addition to the amount of fluorides used in treating our drinking water. This scientific report further analyzes the effects of these fluorides on the human system. Its most dangerous effect is that it slows down the vitally important DNA repair enzyme activity of the 95-point immune system. Fluorides have this effect even in concentrations as low as 1 part per million, the standard dosage which the U.S. Public Health Service set for our drinking water. At this concentration, fluorides are shown to cause serious chromosomal damage. The 1 part per million recommended by our conscientious public servants has also been shown in laboratory experiments to transform normal cells into cancer cells. American Academy of Science studies in 1963 showed that these low levels of fluorides resulted in a marked increase in melanotic tumors, from 12% to 100% in experimental laboratory animals. It also caused interference with the body's production of important neurotransmitters, and lowered their level in the brain. These neurotransmitters have the vital function of protecting against seizures, thus opening the possibility of major increases in strokes and brain damage because of the fluorides in water. Lesser effects of fluorides which have been noted in laboratory tests are sudden mood changes, severe headaches, nausea, hallucinations, irregular breathing, night twitching, damage to fetuses, and various forms of cancer. Government objections to these laboratory findings were raised by the quintessential bureaucrat, Dr. Frank J. Rauscher, the director of the National Cancer Institute, when he claimed that scientists within and without the National Cancer Program have found again that the fluoridation of drinking water does not contribute to a cancer burden for people. This claim, for which he offered no scientific verification, was sharply contested by a longtime scholar of the fluoridation controversy, Dr. John Yamalianis, Dean Burke and other scientists. In his authoritative work, Fluoride, the Aging Factor, which has never been refuted by any scientific study, Dr. Yamalianis finds that from 30,000 to 50,000 deaths a year are directly traceable to fluoridation, from 10 to 20,000 of these deaths being from fluoride-induced cancers. Although some communities have since revoked their agreements to allow fluoridation of their public drinking water supplies, the national campaign continues unabated. No government official has ever admitted that there might be dangers associated with the Ewing Bride which resulted in the fluoridation of the nation's drinking water. West Germany banned fluoridation November 18, 1971, which was surprising, because this is a militarily occupied nation, which is run by the top-secret German Marshall Fund and the John J. McCloy Foundation. Apparently they could no longer silence the German scientists who have proved that fluoridation is a deadly threat to the population. Sweden followed West Germany in banning fluoridation, and the Netherlands officially banned it on June 22, 1973, by order of their highest court. It is of some interest to contemplate the process by which the government bureaucrats arrived at the recommended dosage for fluoridating public drinking water, that is, 1 part per million. Extensive studies must have been made, deliberations gone over by 96-point distinguished scientists over a period of years, before it was finally determined that this was the correct dosage. In fact, no such studies were ever made. Apparently the figure of 1 part per million was selected arbitrarily. It was known that 10 parts per million was much too strong. After several years of using the 1 part per million dosage, government bureaucrats realized that they had made a terrible mistake. The dosage was at least twice as strong as it should have been. The death rates among elderly people from kidney and heart disease began to rise steadily in the first cities to begin fluoridating their water. One critic believes this was a deliberate decision, the final solution to the problem of Social Security payments. When scientists found that 1 part per million dosage of fluoridation transforms normal cells into cancerous cells, the fluoridation program should have been halted immediately. The government agencies realized that, if they did so, they would open the door for thousands of lawsuits against the government. Therefore, The stealthy poisoning of our older generation continues. Oscar Ewing himself, when he was given several dosages to choose from a high of 10 parts per million to a low of 0.5 parts per million, thought he was being safe in selecting a dosage in the lower range. It turned out that he was wrong. The medical monopoly, perhaps, because it is profiting from the steady increase in deaths among the elderly from drinking fluoridated water, refuses to yield on this question. Fluoridation remains one of the four holy waters of the Church of Modern Medicine. Ewing and his minions were also aware of Soviet studies showing that fluorides were extremely important in introducing a docile, sheep-like obedience in the general population. It was well known that for years, breeders of purebred bulls had used doses of fluorides to calm their more intractable bulls, making them much safer to handle. The Soviet Union maintained its concentration camps, since 1940, by administering increasing dosages of fluorides to the prison population in its vast empire, the Gulag Archipelago, the largest network of concentration camps in the world, and the envy of every bureaucrat in Washington. American totalitarian, alike in every way to their Soviet counterparts, also want all dissension stifled, all resistance ended, and a slave population which pays ever-increasing amounts of taxes while having no voice in their own government. The fluoridation campaign has been an important step towards this goal. It may yet prove to have been the crucial step in the complete Sovietization of America. We know that during recent years, the American people have been afflicted with a strange passivity, ignoring each new outrage inflicted upon them by the ravenous federal agents who descend upon their private property in hordes, brandishing automatic weapons which they have no need of using, herding the frightened victims into pens, and degrading them in a manner which no American ever thought to see. This passivity and unwillingness to challenge any authority is merely the first achievement of the fluoridation campaign. This is its initial effect upon the central nervous system. Unfortunately, the further deadly 97-point effects upon the kidneys, the cumulative effect on the heart and other organs, as well as the widespread development of new and fast-spreading cancer, is yet to come. To hasten this cherished objective, not only are American children being given fluoridated water, they also are told to brush their teeth at least 3 times a day with heavily fluoridated toothpaste, which contains 7% of sodium fluoride. Studies show that children habitually ingest about 10% of this solution during each brushing, giving them a daily dose of 30% of the 7% solution in the toothpaste. No doubt this will hasten the Soviet objective. To combat this outrage, one entrepreneur plans to soon market a non-fluoridated toothpaste, which will be called Morgan's Guarantee Toothpaste M-You Can Trust Our Guarantee that this toothpaste contains no harmful fluorides. The source of much of this substance is the Aluminum Company of America, a $5 billion a year enterprise. Its present chairman is Charles W. Perry, a director of the supposedly right-wing think tank, American Enterprise Institute, of which Gene Kirkpatrick is the most highly touted member and principal ornament. The former chairman and still director of Alcoa, William H. Crone George, is an active director of the well-publicized United States-USSR Trade and Economic Council, which is intended to rescue the Soviet Union from economic oblivion. George is also a director of a number of leading defense companies such as TRW Todd Shipyards, International Paper, and the Norfolk and Southern Railway. Alcoa's president is William B. Renner, who is a director of the Shell Oil Company, a firm now controlled by the Rothschild interests. Other directors of Alcoa are William S. Cook, chairman of the Union Pacific Railroad, the base of the Harriman fortune, Alan Greenspan, now chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, whose action in raising the interest rate a few days after he took office precipitated Black Monday, the worst stock market crash in American history. Greenspan's name is not familiar to most Americans, although it should be. He was the chairman of a special commission on Social Security, which finagled a horrendous increase in the amount of withholding tax on every working American. Greenspan was able to do this because he was a highly paid Wall Street consultant, meaning that he could juggle figures to come up with whatever result the Rockefeller monopoly desired. He conducted a specious campaign to persuade the American people that the Social Security program was bankrupt, when in fact it had reserve funds of $22 billion, plus $25 billion which Congress had borrowed directly from the system, and which was a collectible asset. Greenspan also based his demand for a huge increase in the withholding tax, which was nothing but a tax, on a projected 9.6% increase in the inflation rate, when in fact it was only a 3.5% increase. The alarmed public, frightened by President Reagan's absurd claims that the principal beneficiaries of the Social Security system were the idle rich, was hoodwinked into dropping its objections to the increase in tax. However, actual figures on hand 98 point at that time showed that only 3% of the elderly had incomes above $50,000 a year, which in itself was hardly a princely sum in these days of inflation, an inflation which itself was largely created by the government's fiscal policies. Greenspan was the star of the great Social Security crisis of 1983, shrewdly capitalizing on the propaganda barrage that the Social Security system was rapidly going broke. His first finding was that Social Security funds would be in the red from $150 to $200 billion by 1990. At the same time, he was telling his high-paying corporate clients it would be only one-third of that sum. The final increase was what he had told his clients. He also forecast that the consumer price index would rise to 9.2% by 1985. At the same time, he was informing his corporate clients it would be only one-third of that figure. The actual increase was 3.6%. This performance earned Greenspan a prestigious position as partner of J.P. Morgan Company. He is now chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. The New Republic defined the function of this body on January 25, 1988, stating plainly, "The Federal Reserve Board protects the interests of the rich." No one has yet challenged that statement. Greenspan is also a director of the giant media conglomerate, Capital Cities ABC Network, as well as being a trustee of the reputedly right-wing think tank, Hoover Institution, which furnished the powerhouse behind the Reagan Revolution, and which is dominated by the Trotskyite League for Industrial Democracy, a Rockefeller-funded agitprop group. The vice chairman of Alcoa is Forrest Shumway, who is also a director of Transamerica, Apex Corporation, Garrett Corporation, Mack Trucks, the Wix Companies, Gold West Broadcasters, United California Bank, and Natomas, Incorporated, a heady mix of banking interests, heavy industry, and media holdings, which is typical of the monopolists today. They have found the best modus operandi is to control the media, banking and defense industries in a giant combine. Other directors of Alcoa are Paul H. O'Neill, who is a member of the influential Board of Visitors at Harvard University, president of International Paper, and director of the National Westminster Bank, one of England's Big Five. O'Neill was chief of human resources for the U.S. government from 1971 to 77. Paul H. Miller, senior advisor to the prestigious First Boston Investment Group, director of Celanese Corporation, Cummins Engine, Congleum Corporation, Siemens Bank for Savings, New York, and Ogilvy and Mather, Incorporated, one of the nation's leading advertising firms, Franklin H. Thomas, the token black who was U.S. attorney for New York, and then was named head of the Ford Foundation. He is also a director of Citicorp, Citibank, Allied Stores, and Cummins Engine, Sir R.V. Parbo, an Australian tycoon who is chairman of the Western Mining Company. He is also director of Zurich Insurance, the second largest firm in Switzerland, Munich Reinsurance, and Chase Manhattan Bank, Nathan Pearson, who, for many years has been the financial guardian of the Mellon family, handling their major investments, John P. Diesel, president of the giant conglomerate Tenneco. He is also a director of USM-99.USSR Trade and Economic Council with Armand Hammer, and director of First City Bancorp, one of the three Rothschild banks in the United States, John D. Harper, director of Peribus New York, Metropolitan Life and chairman of Koch Enterprises and other fuel companies, John A. Mayer, director of H.J. Heinz Company, the Mellon Bank and Norfolk and Western Railway His son, John, Jr., is general manager of the Morgan Stanley Bankers in England, and vice president of Morgan Guaranty International. Thus we see that the origin of the sodium fluoride controversy stems from close allies of the Chase Manhattan banks and other Rockefeller interests. The operation of the Aluminum Trust has given rise to a new epidemic in the United States. 2.5 million Americans are currently afflicted with a strange, incurable disease called Alzheimer's disease. Its victims now require more than $50 billion worth of medical care each year, and the prognosis always grows darker due to the progressive nature of this illness. It strikes the neurotransmitters of the brain, which, as has already been noted, are adversely affected by fluoride. However, the principal agent seems to be the accumulation of aluminum deposits on the principal nerves of the brain. About 70% of the costs of this illness is borne by the families of the afflicted, because most Medicare and private health insurance programs refuse to pay it. The medical monopoly has been frantically trying to find some other agent in this disease, spending millions to study such factors as genetic predisposition, slow virus, environmental toxins, and immunologic changes, despite the fact that its origins have been traced to the large amounts of aluminum which most Americans began ingesting with their food since the 1920s. Alzheimer's is now causing more than 100,000 deaths annually, and is the fourth leading cause of adult death in the United States. Yet, significantly, there has been no national foundation such as the American Cancer Society or the Arthritis Foundation to investigate its causes, because the medical monopoly already knows the answer. Alzheimer's growing incidence was at first dismissed as growing old, later it was diagnosed as premature senility. It often strikes in the mid-50s. These were the men and women who had grown up in America during the 1920s, a period when the traditional cast iron and earthenware cooking vessels were almost universally replaced by the more modern, and seemingly more convenient, aluminum cookware. The present writer's parents both grew up on farms in rural areas of Virginia. Their food, almost entirely homegrown, was prepared in iron pots over wood-fueled cookstoves. Those Americans born after 1920 had their food prepared in aluminum pots, which were usually heated over gas flames, later electric. This writer's mother often remarked that food cooked over gas flame never tasted like food cooked over wood fires. The reason is that the combustion of poisonous fuel inevitably releases some toxins into the air, and into the food. Electric heat is 100% also said to materially affect food, because of the electric vibrations given off by the heat. By the 1930s, American housewives had learned that it was potentially dangerous to leave many foods in aluminum pots for more than a few minutes. Greens, tomatoes, and other vegetables were known to discolor and became poisonous in a short time. Tomatoes could actually pit and corrode the interior of the aluminum pots in a short time. Many foods turned the pots black. Strangely enough, no one took these obvious warning signs as an indication that cooking food in aluminum pots even for a few minutes might produce unfortunate results. It is now known that cooking any food in an aluminum pot, particularly with fluoridated water, quickly forms a highly poisonous compound. Dr. McGuigan's testimony in a famous court hearing on aluminum effects, the Royal Baking Powder case, revealed that extensive research had shown that boiling water in aluminum pots produced hydroxide poisons, boiling vegetables in aluminum also produced a hydroxide poison, boiling an egg in aluminum produced a phosphate poison, boiling meat in an aluminum pot produced a chloride poison. Any food cooked in aluminum containers would neutralize the digestive juices, produce acidosis, and ulcers. Perhaps the use of aluminum pots produced the widespread indigestion in America, which then necessitated the ingesting of large amounts of antacids containing even more aluminum. After consuming food cooked in aluminum pots over a period from 20 to 40 years, many Americans began to experience serious memory loss. Their mental capacities then deteriorated rapidly, until they were totally unable to fend for themselves or to recognize their spouses of many years. It was then found that concentrations of aluminum in certain areas of the brain had caused permanent deterioration of brain cells and nerve connections. The damage was not only incurable, it was also progressive and not responsive to any known treatment. This epidemic was soon known as Alzheimer's disease. 7% of all Americans over 65 have now been diagnosed as having this disease. Many others have not been diagnosed, they are simply dismissed as senile, incompetent or mentally ill. Dr. Michael Weiner and other physicians have found that the epidemic has been caused, not only by the aluminum cookware, but by the daily increasing ingestion of aluminum from many products in common household usage. The insatiable marketers of aluminum have annually expanded its use in many products, whose consumers have no idea that they are ingesting any type of aluminum. Women's douches now contain solutions of aluminum, which introduces it directly into the system. The most widely used painkillers are such as buffered aspirin contain impressive quantities of aluminum. Aspartame/D, Roar has 44 mg of aluminum per tablet. Kema, Dorsey, has 44 mg of aluminum per tablet. However, the largest single source of aluminum occurs with the daily ingestion of widely prescribed and non-prescription antacid products for stomach upsets. 101. Wife, has 174 mg per dose of aluminum hydroxide. Alternagel, Stewart, has 174 mg of aluminum hydroxide per dose. Delsed, Merrill National, 174 mg aluminum per dose. Estimulem, Reiter, 265 mg of aluminum per dose. Mylanta Second, Stewart, 116 mg aluminum per dose. A study of current victims of Alzheimer's would probably find that most of them, on their physician's advice, had been ingesting large amounts of these antacids daily for years. Non-prescription antidiarrheal drugs also contain significant amounts of aluminum. Esilid, Central, has 370 mg of aluminum salts per milliliters. Kaopectate concentrate, Upjohn, has 290 mg aluminum per milliliters. Aluminum ammonium sulfate is widely used as a buffer and neutralizing agent by manufacturers of cereals and baking powder. Aluminum potassium sulfate, known as aluminum flour or aluminum meal, is widely used in baking powder and clarifying sugar. The annual use of sodium aluminum phosphate has now reached the amount of 19 million kilograms per year. It is used in large amounts in cake mixes, frozen dough, self-rising flour, and processed foods, in an average amount per product of from 3 to 3.5%, some 300,000 kilograms of sodium aluminum sulfates are used in household baking powders each year, averaging from 21 to 26% of the bulk of these products. Aluminum wrap is now everywhere. Toothpaste is packaged in tubes lined with aluminum. There are aluminum seals on many food and drink products, and soft drinks everywhere are now packaged in aluminum cans. While the amount of aluminum ingested on any given day from all of these sources may be infinitesimal, the parade of products coated with or mixed with aluminum available on a daily basis is frightening. Its effects are the equivalent to that of a slow virus, as the metal accumulates at vital points in the system, particularly in the human brain. Thus, the number of Alzheimer's victims is probably outnumbered by the number of potential victims, who will later be afflicted with its terrible symptoms. 102.